started off biblical wisdom last time and got a couple more things to say about the book of Proverbs especially. I have some Proverbs to jumpstart a discussion, and after that, we can go anywhere you want. I actually have done Proverbs before, and it is on my website. The outline is very similar to what we're doing right now. First part of it was what I would call encoding biblical wisdom, which is explaining how the wisdom literature is put together and how it works. And then the next thing I talk about is in Proverbs 3, the difference between knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And we'll talk about that for a second here. Chapters 4 and 5 are the beauty of wisdom. And you've all heard this from me before, but it's worth repeating. And I got this from Rabbi Sacks. This is not original with me. In the Bible, there's three voices. There's the voice of the prophet, the voice of the priest, and the voice of the king. And as you're reading scripture, it's often very useful to figure out what voice is being used. The voice of the priest is used to teach Torah, teach the law, and give understanding about the scriptures. The difference between holy and common, clean and unclean, and to teach the Torah. That's the voice of the priest. The voice of the prophet is God speaking through a man to a situation in Israel that he wants corrected. As far as I know, God never sends a prophet to Israel to say, wow, you guys are doing a really good job right now. Hey, keep it up. The only time you ever see a prophet is when they've gone off the rails. God sends a prophet and speaks into that situation with the hope that they will listen and correct. Sadly, they very seldom do. And then the voice of the king, which is where we are in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and so forth, that's the voice of human wisdom. And human wisdom is perfectly good wisdom. The Torah doesn't cover every situation. You know, it gives you case studies and it gives you principles of law and how to reason about things. Silly example, it says if you see your neighbor's ox falling down under a load or in a ditch, you stop and help him out. Well, meditating on that, if you see your neighbor with a flat tire, you stop and help him out. And the whole point there is you're supposed to look after other people. So the principles, of course, are given in an agricultural, biblical setting, but they're universal. And a little meditation, you can find modern applications for all of them. So the voice of the king, as I say, is the voice of human wisdom. For example, in Proverbs, there's no sin co-signing alone. It's just stupid. So the voice of human wisdom is don't co-sign alone. Don't be surety for your neighbor. And especially don't be surety for a stranger. Human wisdom. Torah doesn't cover that because there's no sin involved. It's just don't do that. It's stupid. And then chapters 8 and 10 is wisdom again, present in the creation. And then 10 is the power of the tongue. And what you'll see as you read Proverbs is there will be sections where you'll see a whole bunch of Proverbs that tangentially talk about the same subject. And they'll stack so that you have actually an argument by the end of it, even though each one of them is worthy of contemplation. First thing is the difference between wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Knowledge is data. The sun comes up in the east. Those kinds of things. It's just data that you may not know as a young man, but the book tells you about it. So if you've never been to the North Pole, you don't know anything about snow and so forth. But that's all in there, and it's all basically knowledge. Understanding is figuring out how the knowledge applies. For example, I know that if it gets cold, I'd better put on a coat. That's understanding. And then wisdom is knowing how to apply understanding and data to a situation that's novel. So you're able to, from your experience and wisdom, extrapolate things quickly, and you're able to navigate through life fairly well. Knowledge and understanding just require some brains. Person is reasonably intelligent, he can acquire lots of knowledge and understanding. And that, unfortunately, is sometimes a problem, because you get very smart and clever people who have a lot of knowledge and a lot of understanding, but very little wisdom. Those are the people that think that they can solve homelessness or whatever. You just pay more taxes, the weather will change and everything will get better. That is a lack of wisdom, but not necessarily a lack of knowledge and understanding. And one other thing before we go on. Remember I said last time that Proverbs are stark, black and white. Everything is either wise or foolish. Everyone is either righteous or wicked. There's no shades of gray. And he uses the example of an old Tom and Jerry cartoon, where you have righteous mouse and evil cat. And the whole cartoon is the conflict between righteous mouse and evil cat. The example he uses, and I just mentioned it, but I didn't go far enough, is there's a vignette in one of the Tom and Jerry cartoons, and I've seen them all, where the mouse is running, and he runs toward the wall, and he stops, and he takes out a piece of paper, and he draws a tunnel in it, puts it up there, and blacks it, and then goes through the tunnel. And then the cat comes behind him and tries to go through, and of course slams into the wall. How that applies to Proverbs is the understanding of the wise is the universe works to the benefit of the righteous. So the righteous mouse is able to sort of bend reality, if you will, to save himself in that situation, but the wicked cat couldn't do that. Kugel is using that for an example as he talks about the black and white of the world of biblical wisdom. So, where I want to start tonight is I will start with one of James Kugel's examples out of his book. And then we can either move to another one that I've got ready, or we can launch off on one that you want to explore. I'm in the section of his book called Solomon's Riddles. He says, another one-line form, this one from the book of Proverbs, echoes Ecclesiastic's statement about the value of a person's name. By the way, the translations here are Kugel's own. He's qualified to do that. In the goodness of the righteous, a city rejoices, and when the wicked disappear, there is gladness. And that's Proverbs 11:10. I'm now quoting from the book. At first, one might think that this proverb simply presents a straightforward contrast. A city rejoices in the life of its righteous and in the death of its wicked. But that is not quite the point. If such had been the proverb's intention, I think he would have written something more like, and here again, in the lives of the righteous and not in their goodness, the city rejoices, and when the wicked die and not disappear, which is precisely a synonym for death, there is gladness. So, in the lives of the righteous instead of in the goodness of the righteous. And his point is, in this proverb, both the righteous and the wicked are dead already. The point here is the life of the righteous has been a blessing to the city, and the righteous name lives on after him as an example of someone to emulate, as an example of someone who has done good, as the example of someone righteous. The wicked, when they die, perish, because nobody wants to remember them except perhaps as a bad example. So if you read that proverb, again, in his translation, this is 11:10, and read it now with that understanding. In the goodness of the righteous, a city rejoices. And when the wicked disappear, there is gladness. In other words, when there's no longer any memory of the wicked, we still remember the life and goodness of the righteous. So with that, if somebody has a proverb or set of proverbs that they've got chucked up and are just wanting to discuss, we can do that now. Or I can go through a series of proverbs talking about wealth. Blank looks. Okay, we'll do that then. So wealth, I'm going to give you a list of the proverbs. Proverb 10:15, Proverb 18:11, Proverb 14:24, Proverb 28:8, Ecclesiastes 5:10, 5:19, and 6:2. Those all deal with the subject of wealth. And when you take them all together, you get a very rounded picture of the idea of biblical wealth from the perspective of human wisdom, the voice of the king. So let's start with Proverbs 10:15, and I'm going to contrast that with Proverbs 18:11. So Proverbs 10:15, a rich man's wealth is his strong city. The poverty of the poor is their ruin. And then Proverbs 18:11, a rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in his imagination. Now, you should notice a couple of things. First off, we're talking about a rich man's wealth, and we're talking about it in two senses. In both cases, the rich man regards his wealth as a strong city, which would be a metaphor for security. I am in a strong city with fortified walls and so forth, so my wealth is a strong city that protects me. Both of those are saying the same thing in that first part. The second one is then, the poverty of the poor is their ruin, and like a high wall in his imagination. So let's take the one in 10:15 first. The example that I use is it contrasts now a rich man's wealth, the poverty of the poor. So a rich man's wealth is a strong city, and the poverty of the poor is their ruin. So this is A, B, A prime, B prime. The first part of it is obvious. He regards it as protection. But the poverty of the poor is their ruin. The example I use when I teach this is, let's say you get up in the morning and you're getting ready to go to work. You go out to your car, your battery's dead. If you are a rich man, it's an inconvenience. You call AAA, they drive out there, they jump your car, perhaps give you a new battery, you're out $100 depending on inflation, you get to work, and it's nothing more to you than an inconvenience. But let's say you're poor and your battery has died. You don't have enough money to either replace your battery or to call a tow truck. So what you have done then is you have missed a good part of a day's work. You've got the expense of repairing your car, which you can't afford. And in addition to not being able to afford to repair your car, you have lost the wages you would have gotten had your car taken you to work. So in this scenario, the rich man's wealth is in fact his strong city. It protects him. And the poor man's poverty is his ruin. He's in very bad shape at the simple misfortune of a dead battery, which I'm sure everybody has been through. Not that rare. So that's the sense of that first proverb. Well, now let's go over to the second one now, because it's different. A rich man's wealth is his strong city. Still the same thing from the rich man's perspective. He still trusts in his wealth. And like a high wall in his imagination. There's the key there. Not actually like a high wall, but a high wall in his imagination. And the deal there is, and we've read other places in Scripture, in prophecy and so forth, when Israel falls into wickedness and the Babylonians come and sweep everybody away, they're going to take the wealthy as well as the poor. Everybody's going to go. And in that case, your wealth is not going to be a protection whatsoever. So what you have is two different proverbs talking about wealth, and they really have two different meanings because the situations are different. One is a minor inconvenience. I've got a dead battery. The other one is a major inconvenience. I got Babylonians at the gate. And if you got Babylonians at the gate and people are starving, you're going to be starving right along with them, and your wealth isn't going to protect you. Should they breach the walls, you're going to go down with the city, and again, your wealth is not going to protect you. And that's how I read this, and like a high wall in his imagination, it isn't really, depending on the circumstance. So now let's look at another proverb. I like those two because the contrast is really easy. So let's go to Proverbs 14:24. The crown of the wise is their wealth, but the folly of fools brings folly. One other thing that I probably ought to tell you for background. I've said several times now, this is black and white. It's cartoonish in the contrast that it draws. In the Bible, there are several kinds of fool. The first one is the young fool. A young fool is just young. He's a fool because he doesn't have any experience yet. The whole book of Proverbs is aimed at the young fool. And what the book of Proverbs is trying to do is jumpstart his maturation so he doesn't get burned so bad in his folly. And, oh, by the way, I said last time, most of Proverbs is aimed at young men because everybody at that age is a young fool. A young fool can be trained. A young fool can be taught. A young fool can be disciplined. The next one is a mocking fool, or another one is a prating fool, sort of the same thing, I believe. A mocking fool or a prating fool. Prating means one that's mouth is always running. Never listen to anybody because he doesn't shut up. That's a prating fool. A mocking fool is one who mocks the advice of the wise. Both of those are running their mouths instead of taking advantage of the wisdom that is before them. And then the third kind is what's called a hardened fool. And for a hardened fool, the Bible offers no hope. So now, come back to our proverb about wealth. Proverb 14:24. The crown of the wise is their wealth, but the folly of fools brings folly. So what would you do with that? First question, is wealth in this case good or bad? The comment was it's good, but it's a metaphor. Going back to our example of evil cat and righteous mouse, the worldview of the wise is that the universe works for them. So a wise man could be expected to have wealth. I mean, of course, he's righteous and he's wise. Why wouldn't he have wealth? So his wealth is simply the cherry on top of the cake in this proverb. Not necessary to his wisdom, but the universe just works for him. So this wealth is the icing on the cake, cherry on top, however you want to describe that metaphor. But the folly of fools brings folly. And this is Johnny-ology. One thing about a fool, of course, is a fool's behavior is folly. That's sort of the definition of a fool, is someone whose behavior is folly. And his folly simply compounds itself. He doesn't just do one stupid thing and then quit. He keeps doing stupid stuff. So in this case, just as a wise man, by his wisdom and his righteousness, of course he's going to also be wealthy. A fool, in his folly, is going to keep getting deeper and deeper into the mess that he has caused for himself. That would be how I would look at that. So let's go now to Proverbs 28:8. Whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. By the way, prophet here, you all know that the Torah prohibits charging interest, especially to the poor. So that's illegal, according to the Torah. So you all understand interest. Profit is what's called a discounted loan. So Mike needs to borrow 100 bucks. I only give him 90, but I write his debt as 100. That's a discounted loan. So I am not charging interest per se, but I'm still charging him for the loan. That's what's meant by profit here. There's nothing wrong with investing money in a business deal. If you invest money in a business deal, you expect to make money. Nothing wrong with that at all. What we're talking about here is a loan, a personal loan to somebody, typically to somebody who really needs the money. Now, if Mike, on the other hand, wants to open a hardware store, I am perfectly okay for me to lend Mike $1,000 to buy screws and widgets, and as he operates his store, I'm expecting some of the profit back. Nothing wrong with that at all. That's a business investment, and that's not a problem, because I'm sharing in his risk. I've lent him the $1,000, and if he manages poorly and goes belly up, I've lost my $1,000. But on the other hand, if he does well and makes a profit and so forth, I will share in that profit at some rate that we both agree on. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Here we're talking about someone who makes a loan and multiplies his wealth basically at the expense of the poor. So he multiplies his wealth. His wealth increases because he makes loans at interest or discounted, and so is then taking advantage of the people who need to borrow his money. That's what the bad thing about this is. And then part two, that person gathers it, wealth, for him who is generous to the poor. So what's happening there is this wealthy guy thinks that he is making more and more and more wealth by biblically unscrupulous means, and he's looking and saying, boy, look at all the money I'm making and so forth. And what the proverb says is you're really storing it up for the righteous one who is generous to the poor. And there's a proverb later on which says, money given to the poor is lent to God. He will repay. So this is the biblical wisdom worldview. If you've gotten your money unrighteously, what you're really doing is you are creating a reservoir of wealth that is going to flow to the righteous who is going to use that money in a beneficial way. That's how I read that proverb. So go to Ecclesiastes now. Ecclesiastes 5:10. I'm simply going through with the idea of surveying how the wise regard wealth in a biblical context. So, Ecclesiastes 5:10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Wisdom, talking about money. Now, the first sentence of that sets it up. And that is, he who loves money. So that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the righteous who are just naturally crowned with wealth because the universe works for them. We're talking about somebody who loves money. This is not a rich, righteous person. This is a person who is greedy and loves money. First thing it says is it won't satisfy him, and he will not be satisfied with his income. In other words, the wealth he has will not satisfy him, comma, Furthermore, he is not going to regard his income as being satisfactory. So I'm not happy with what I got, and I'm not getting more fast enough, is the attitude here. And you all know, in Ecclesiastes, the word vanity there is Hebrew hevel, which, by the way, is the name of the brother of Cain, spelled the same way. And what it means is ephemeral or insubstantial. We think of vanity as being pride. That's not what's being talked about here. In Ecclesiastes, vanity here is not pride. It is something that is ephemeral, doesn't last, is insubstantial, unimportant. So verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? So we're talking about this person who loves money. As he starts amassing wealth, what's going to happen is he's also going to amass people who want to get at his wealth. First thing that happens when somebody wins the lottery is he discovers all sorts of friends and cousins he never knew he had before. That's why many big lottery winners choose to remain anonymous, because they know that they're going to be covered over with people who, oh, little Johnny really needs an operation, and that kind of stuff. Then they're going to get inundated with hard luck stories going after their newfound wealth. So the first part is when goods increase, in other words, this lover of money has increased his wealth, he's also going to find that those who would eat his wealth, and eat there is a metaphor, also increase. So rich people have lots of people who hang around them because they are rich. And he gets to look at it with his eyes, but it's going out faster than he wants it to. Because remember, he's not satisfied with how much he has, and he's not satisfied with how fast it's coming in. So the fact that people start coming to him as he's wealthy and start putting demands on his wealth is even more noxious. Now, contrast that, verse 12, contrasted with the man who loves money. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he's little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. The simple laborer who has earned his daily bread can sleep soundly and be at peace because he's earned enough to feed himself and a place to sleep. But this rich guy who has got all this money has got a full stomach because he's had a really nice meal, but he's not at peace. Whereas the laborer who has earned his daily bread is at peace. So that's yet another perspective on wealth in the wisdom tradition. The rabbis do say that the greatest form of charity is to do business, which is to say the best thing you can do for a poor person is give him a job so that he can earn money and stand on his own 2 feet. I completely agree with that. As to whether or not giving to good causes can be counted to a tithe, I think that can, because we don't have a temple to maintain anymore. And God bless RMF, but we couldn't absorb everybody's tithe, assuming that you all are doing a biblical tithe. We just couldn't absorb it. So yeah, sending money to charities and so forth, I think it very much counts as a tithe, simply because you got no place else to put it. Next one is in 5:19, just down from where we were. Ecclesiastes 5:19. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, that is the gift of God. Remember, we just talked about the person who loves money. This is now in contrast. This is a person whom God has given wealth, but it's not the sole object of his life. And so he's given him wealth because, parenthesis, he's righteous, because we talked about wealth being a crown on the head of the wise/righteous. So here, someone who is presumably wise or righteous has accumulated wealth, and great possessions, and God has given them the power to enjoy it. In other words, he doesn't sit and worry about all the people who are suddenly showing up to eat the wealth that he has generated. He simply enjoys it. When he wants to go to the movie, he can afford a movie ticket. When his battery dies, it's an inconvenience. It's not a tragedy. If he wants a new car, he can buy it. Nothing wrong with that, because this person is righteous and wise. So the wealth that he gets comes with joy, as opposed to the wealth that the greedy man gets, which comes with worry. So the last one I'm going to be is Ecclesiastes 6:2. Actually, pick it up at 6:1. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity, it is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. That's a stillborn. But the whole point here is, remember we talked in the previous vignette about a wealthy man who enjoys his wealth and is given the ability by God to enjoy the wealth that he has and be satisfied with it. And I said, as in parentheses, this is a righteous, wise man. Contrast here is someone who is given a lot of wealth, but is not given the power to enjoy it. So anyway, that's all I have to say about wealth. I want to change subjects entirely here. This is a completely different subject, still in Proverbs. I want to go to Proverbs 14:4. This is one of my favorite proverbs, Proverbs 14:4. And it says, where there are no oxen, the manger is clean, but abundant crops come by the strength of the ox. Now, how would we apply that today, since none of us that I know of has an ox? When there are no oxen, the manger is clean, but abundant crops come by the strength of the ox. What does that mean today? Comment was, a clean manger means that there's no manure to shovel. So the first thing is, it says, that means you don't have to shovel manure. How does that apply today? If you have an ox, you have to shovel manure, but you get lots of corn. You get lots of grain. How does that apply today? If you get rid of coal power plants, the air is very clean, but you have no electricity. What I'm saying is, the extreme environmentalism that we have, that insists that we have no pollution or no exhaust on anything, is in fact shutting down the strength of the industry that produces abundance. Now, don't get me wrong, I am very much in favor of clean water and clean air. But what is happening in the environmental movement is, it's a religious issue. We can't have coal power plants, you can't have gas stoves, you can't have automobiles, you can't have diesel trucks, you can't have anything, because all of them are like the ox that puts out manure. And that's what manure is the waste of an ox. And similarly, the exhaust pipe puts out the waste of a car or a truck. And I certainly don't have any problem in making that as clean as possible. But understand that in that waste, which you have to take care of, in other words, you have to shovel out the crib or the manger. So if you never shovel out the crib or the manger, then pretty soon your ox is going to be hip deep in crap. So you got to take care of the waste. But waste is a natural thing that comes as a byproduct of productivity and food. So the idea that we have to get rid of everything that produces any waste is a religious argument, and it is foolish. The point of this proverb is, you do have to take care of the waste. You can't just let it accumulate. Because, as I say, pretty soon your ox isn't going to be able to move, because he's going to be up to his withers in crap. So you have to shovel out the stall, which means you have to take care of your waste. But you also have to understand that life and productivity generate waste.